Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
Democracy in the Blood: How Nationalism Enabled a Project of Radical Individual Freedom in Sweden. Lars Trägårdh. It has become customary to equate nationalism and the nation-state with brutal border policing, a politics of exclusion, welfare chauvinism, even xenophobia and racism. Given the experience of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, this comes as no surprise. And certainly the politics of Donald Trump and Brexit, as well as the rise of right-wing populism, authoritarian nationalism, and managed democracy around the world, has further underlined this dynamic. However, equally significant is the experience of nationalism in the Nordic countries, where notions of national community, social solidarity, and individual freedom, liberty, equality, fraternity, to invoke the slogans of the French Revolution, came to infuse a social contract founded on social trust on the one hand and individual autonomy on the other. To understand the rise of a Nordic variety of democratic left-wing nationalism, one must grasp the central importance of the concept of the national narrative. The stories told about a nation's history and identity, its values, institutions, and practices. That is, its political culture, in a broad anthropological sense. Thus, the development of a modern democratic nationalism in Sweden was founded on both enduring institutional and political legacies and on a potent national narrative that linked Swedish national identity to key values such as democracy, equality, individual freedom, and the rule of law. The chief architect of this modern national narrative was the predominant Swedish historian of the 19th century, Erik Gustaf Geijer. He established an enduring trope that extolled the two Swedish freedoms, that of the nation and that of the individual. The central heroes in Geijer's narrative were the king and the Odelbunde, yeoman peasant, who were joined in an alliance against the treacherous nobility, which was bent upon undermining the power of the king on the one hand and throwing the peasants into a state of feudal serfdom, on the other hand. The influence of Geijer on the way in which Swedes have imagined themselves and their national character has been enormous. His foundational myth of the Swedish nation was reproduced in textbooks that were assigned to most, if not all, Swedish students by the beginning of the 20th century, and his conception of Swedish history and Swedish national identity found expression in the writings of political figures spanning the entire ideological spectrum. Even the prominent Swedish historian Erik Lönnrot, who devoted much of his professional life to disproving Geijer's assertions, conceded that Geijer's conception of history, characterized by profound originality and suggestive force, entered into the imagination of the succeeding generations. Indeed, whether or not Geijer's interpretations are factually correct, they certainly penetrated into the history books, the literature, and the political discourse. Lönnrot wistfully noted in 1943, possibly reflecting on his own rather futile efforts to debunk Geijer's narrative, that even 100 years later, it has not fully loosened its grip. For someone like Geijer, who came to history through the study of sagas, myths, and folk songs, it was perhaps only fitting that his efforts at history have themselves turned into myth. Furthermore, as with many other national myths, it is a story that contains a measure of truth, if artistically embellished. The Swedish peasants were indeed unique in that they not only kept the land and escaped feudalism and serfdom, but they even retained political representation at both the national level, as the Fourth Estate, and at the local village level, in the form of self-government. As the American specialist on early modern Sweden, Michael Roberts, has put it, "It may well be true that the idealization of the yeoman peasant by such writers as E.G. Geijer has been proved to have but a shaky historical basis. Yet it is still safe to say that the peasant in medieval Sweden retained his social and political freedom to a greater degree, played a greater part in the politics of the country, and was altogether a more considerable person than in any other Western European country." This narrative found its way into 19th and 20th century historical literature and history textbooks. Let me here confine myself to a few examples. Consider the classic standard school text on Swedish history by Udner, first published in 1899 and reprinted many times thereafter. Having dramatically retold the story of Engelbrecht, a 15th century figure celebrated for his role in defending both the nation and the free peasants from the Danish king and the power-hungry nobles, Udner concludes, "He gave back to Sweden's almuge, the little people or peasantry, its freedom and independence. He called the townsmen and the peasants to national assemblies. He awoke the slumbering national feeling by uniting the various separate groups in order to save the nation. From his time, one can talk of not simply different provinces, estates, and classes in Sweden, but also of a Swedish nation." Such an essentialist view of Swedishness, derived from Geijer's conception of Swedish history and national character, was also common at the outset among leading figures within the fledgling workers' movement, as it began to gain strength at the turn of the century. Take, for example, the Social Democrat Bengt Lidfors, who, during the Great General Strike of 1909, lost himself in a particularly romantic, heroic vision of the Swedish working class movement, one tinged with xenophobia to boot. "The working class," he wrote, "is the marrow and core of the Swedish people, the blood inherited from the parents through innumerable Swedish generations. It is folket that stands up to all the managers, bosses, stockholders, with mostly exotic names and of foreign descent, like the Swedish almugen under Engelbrecht did against the Danish lords of the past." However, it was only after the collapse of the Second International, and with the reforms of 1920, which finally introduced general suffrage, and thus a sense of the inclusion of the working class in the nation, that the Social Democrats began to move aggressively to mobilize the national theme. Soon after the First World War, a series of books and articles appeared that signaled this new attitude on the part of the Social Democrats. In 1926, Per Albin Hansson, the leader of the Social Democratic Party and the future Prime Minister, wrote a key article called "Sweden for the Swedes, the Swedes for Sweden," in which he opened by quoting from a slogan used at a Social Democratic election meeting in 1924. "Long live the fatherland, that Sweden which one day will become a good home to all Swedes." Here, Hansson played with a common right-wing jingoistic slogan, consciously challenging the received notion that nationalist rhetoric belonged on the political right. On the other hand, as the phrase "one day will become" makes clear, his Swedish nation was a nation in the making, the nation of the future. While småfolket, the little people, were still not fully accepted, and Sweden was still a class-based society, the conditions had now changed. After the introduction of general suffrage, Hansson wrote, "It is entirely up to the folket itself how the country is run." The conquest of Sweden for the Swedes could be accomplished through the ballot, and only lethargy and indifference stood in the way. In this article, Hansson gave voice to an early version of the idea of folkhemmet, a good home to all Swedes, as he put it in this early rendition, a concept that he was to introduce in its definitive and more catchy form 2 years later at the 1928 Party Congress. Significantly, this speech was titled "Folkhemmet, Med borgar hemmet, the home of the people, the home of citizens. A double title deployed to stress the civic meaning of the people as much as, if not more than, the ethnic reading. People as demos rather than ethnos. Two important mutations in the discourse of the Social Democrats that are signalled with this move should be noted. The first is a shift towards a nation-statist socialism that rejected classic Marxist hostility to the bourgeois state, associated with the notion that the state is destined to vanish with the arrival of socialism. And the second is the tendency to replace the confrontational concept of class with the more inclusive notion of the folk. A first phase in the process of appropriating the national was characterized by the influence of the Austro-Marxists and their affirmation of the national idea as such. Younger social democrats like Nils Karleby and Rikard Lindström wrote a number of articles and books in the mid-1920s that were directly influenced by Otto Bauer's great work on the nationality question, Die Nationalitätenfrage und die Sozialdemokratie. Citing Bauer, Lindström asserted that socialism must be built on a national basis, and that we must accept the nation as a given. To deny the nation is to deny life itself. He agreed with Bauer that each nation has its own national character and its own peculiar spirit. This represented, of course, a major revision of Marx's own view of the nation, which was that it was destined for the dustbin of history, first to be fatally undermined by global capitalism, and then to be swept away by the world revolution. During a second phase, culminating in the 1930s, the empty category of national character was increasingly filled with a positive and concrete content that linked the notion of a Swedish national socialism, as Lindström put it in one of his many articles, to pro-statist and pro-democratic attitudes, themes that were then developed into a fully-fledged folklig national doctrine, according to which the Swedish Nordic democratic tradition was an expression of the peculiar Swedish folksjäl, soul of the people. In elaborating this theory of what we may call, paraphrasing Stalin, democracy in one country, the Social Democrats explicitly attached themselves to the by now traditional historical discourse associated with Geijer. This formulation of a social democratic version of Geijer's national narrative was deployed in direct opposition to conservative attempts at mobilizing nationalist sentiments for their own political purpose. Conservatives were attacked for attempting to usurp the national and patriotic idea and accused of being un-Swedish. Thus, Lindström, for example, would argue that the youth section of the Conservative Party was not in touch with the true Swedish national tradition. Our alert Swedish youth does not desire to become the hirelings of industriherrar and godsägare, industrial lords and estate owners. It wants to stand on a folklig, popular/national basis, and thereby links up to the best traditions in our history. These, the best traditions in our history, were explicitly those of Engelbrecht and the Swedish peasants. Thus Hansson would recall the legacy of Engelbrecht, the man we from our childhood years have learned to see and honour as a man of the people, including the founding of the Parliament and the fight for national and personal freedom. He wrote, "It is a long time ago that the old peasant chief answered the calling of the herrar, lords, with a stern reminder that the workers are flesh of our flesh and bone from our bone." But the same is still true. The best of democratic tradition can be found among peasants and workers. Just like the peasant class, during its struggle for influence, protected the folk freedom, so has the working class. Here there is a common inheritance to administer. Thus, Engelbrecht and Gustav Vasa, the two great liberators of the nation and the people, became for us in school the ideals, the mighty freedom fighters to whom we looked up and whom we wanted to follow. This was the tradition of freedom, in which the Social Democratic Workers' Movement was merely the last link, Hansen argued. He continued, "The concept of freedom has, over time, been extended. Lordship and oppression have been broken down in new areas. New folk groups and classes have successfully fought their own freedom fight, won equal citizenship rights, liberated themselves from slavery and slave mentalities. Figures have been added to our gallery of heroes. A few older ones have perhaps been pushed aside, but others remain. It is warranted to speak of a tradition of freedom in our country, independent of the changes in society." Thus, he concluded, "you have a tradition to safeguard, a duty to fulfill towards the present and the future. In this matter, as in all, be Swedish." Indeed, Hansen claimed, "our Swedish people is essentially democratic. It loves freedom and hates oppression." That is, democracy in Sweden was not simply a matter of ideology or of dry constitutional arrangements, but it was rooted in the very soul of the people. He explained, "it is with every reason that we Swedes are proud of our country. It is a country of folk freedom and folklicht self-government, where democracy is rooted not merely in the constitution, but also in our traditions and in the disposition of the folk." These words were spoken during the early 1930s, just as the Social Democrats and the Peasant Party formed a lasting popular/populist alliance under the banner of Folkhemmet. And it is with the Peasant Worker Alliance of 1933 that the social democratic deployment of the Geijerian trope reaches its fullest form. The old pitting of a nationally minded king and patriotic and freedom loving peasant against the treacherous and faithless landed lord is reinvented. The aristocrats of old become the industrialists and capitalists of today. The peasants are joined by the workers as the true representatives of the folk and the nation. As in the German right-wing nationalist imagination, the Jew is equated with cosmopolitan capitalism, so for Swedish left-wing nationalists, the capitalist elite is viewed with enduring suspicion as not sufficiently national or patriotic, a trope that endured through the debate over Swedish EU membership in the early 1990s. Central to this nationalist turn of the Swedish Social Democrats was a general shift after 1929 from class, to folk as the key organizing concept. That year, Hansson wrote an important essay in the leading social democratic journal Tiden entitled Folk och Klass, in which he explicitly embraced the notion that the party must project itself as a party of the people, so as not to be trapped within the exclusionary and adversarial language of class and class struggle. Showing a fine understanding of the power of words, Hansson wrote that the class struggle might be an ever so horrible fact, a fact that must not, however, blind us to the superiority of the folk concept as a propaganda tool. He wrote, "There is something much more exciting about the thought that we are fighting for the folk. To such an appeal, everybody will listen. In the coming together of the folk, most of us want to be a part." Indeed, such sentiments led Hansson closer and closer to a truly all-embracing national/nationalist position. If the initial move was to include both peasants and workers as bona fide members of the folk, joined in a common struggle against Herrarna, by 1935, even this residual notion of class conflict was eliminated. In yet another speech featuring Engelbrecht, given on the occasion of the Day of the Peasant, he declared that it was gemenskapen, community/unity, among the Swedes that Engelbrecht wanted to bring about. Today it is also true that popular national, folkligt nationella aspirations can have no other goal. Although there is much that separates us into groups and classes, in the midst of all that, gemenskapen still spills forth. The nation is one and the people are one. We live together and are dependent on each other. The list of all the different people whose efforts contributed to the common good of the national community is telling, and utterly unlike any that a Social Democrat would have produced 10 years earlier. The peasant, the worker, the teacher, the thinker and the leader, the fisherman, the shopkeeper, the housewife. Of course, this rather high-strung nationalist rhetoric must be read against the developments in Germany, where just a few years earlier the Protestant peasants and many other sections of the Volk had overwhelmingly voted for Hitler, making the failure on the part of the German Social Democrats to harness and appropriate the national feeling only too apparent. Still, the tone and language of Hansson is striking as he plays with the deep ambivalence of the Volk concept. One moment the Volk is fighting Fuchtar and Heerar, the next moment the great Volkhem is invoked. Together, these references form a Jaeyerish discourse, part mythical, part historical, on the founding of Sweden and the essence of Swedishness, to which Hansson attaches, at the tail end, himself, the Swedish working class and the Social Democratic Party. In this conception, Folkhemmet, the historically rooted identification of the national with the democratic, came together with singular power, ethnos and demos merging in what came to be the central metaphor of the National Socialist Swedish welfare state. The Social Democrats were, in the process, transformed from a marginal party of the unpatriotic internationalist left into the dominant and eminently national party, and it was their version of Swedish national identity that came to be the hegemonic one. Furthermore, this was a hegemonic position that was soon to transcend the realm of political rhetoric and utopian visions. From 1933, they came to shape the construction of modern Sweden at both the rhetorical and institutional levels. This brings us to the question of the relationship between the individual and the state, for the nationalism of the left is rooted not just in an essentialist notion of a democratic Swedish soul of the people, but also in a statism that links social equality, national solidarity, and individual autonomy to the beneficial power of the state. Indeed, democracy is in Sweden built on a basis fundamentally different from the one associated with the development of liberal democracy in the West, where, broadly speaking, it grew out of gentry and bourgeois opposition to the absolutist state. In England, the story of parliamentary democracy is the story of successful gentry resistance to the king in the name of defending and preserving ancient English liberties. In France and Germany, civil society and the public sphere, as the German historian Reinhard Koselleck and later the philosopher Jürgen Habermas have shown, formed as a response to absolutism, as a free social space for critical, moral, and increasingly political discourse. The institutions of bourgeois civil society, at first secret or semi-legal societies, later officially sanctioned, if still feared, by the state, became the locus for social and political utopianism, for the production and dissemination of public opinion, and came to serve as a powerful fourth estate. Furthermore, as the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor has argued, the development of a modern Western democratic political culture was a process that entailed the universalization and democratization of the rights and sensibilities once peculiar to the noble members of society, and the gradual mutation of aristocratic privilege into human and civil rights. It was a process of raising formerly downtrodden members of society to the level of the privileged, of granting recognition and aristocratic come human dignity to all. In Sweden, on the other hand, the construction of modern democracy can be seen as a process of generalizing the political culture of the local peasant assembly. Because the Swedish peasantry largely escaped feudalism and even retained its rights to be represented as a separate estate in the Riksdag, it could play a role unparalleled elsewhere. This unique position of the Swedish peasantry allowed for an enduring alliance between the quasi-absolute monarchy and the peasant estate against the common enemy, the nobility. Thus, the Swedish gentlemanly class never came to play the same leading role as was the case elsewhere in Western Europe. The consequence was that Swedish political culture came to be cast in a mould very different from that of other Western democracies. Far from generalising noble or bourgeois privilege, the organising principle was that of levelling, of eliminating rather than extending privileges and special rights. Ultimately, it was a process of universalising the egalitarianism of the peasant community, of reducing noble and bourgeois rights until there were but peasants, the people, left. If, in the West, the ideal type was the honourable gentleman, in Sweden it was the modest peasant, as the Swedish journalist Maciek Zaremba has put it. It was the luck, and some would claim the political genius, of the Swedish Social Democrats to be able to tap into this potent tradition during the high age of statist nationalism after the First World War. Thus, during the famous deals between the peasants and workers' parties during the early 1930s, the Social Democrats managed to shoulder the mantles of both monarchical statism and peasant populism by becoming, on the one hand, the party of state, and on the other, the voice of the people. The time-honoured tradition of seeing the king-slash-state axis as an ally against the upper classes mutated and deepened with the democratisation of the political system and the coming to power of the workers' and peasants' parties. Instead of seeing civil society as a crucial repository of freedom and protection against the power of the state was seen as having a legitimate and decisive role to play in eradicating inequalities and the remaining privileges of the upper classes. Swedish political culture can thus be said to be democratic rather than liberal. It is characterized by centralized power and uniformity, as well as by an ancient tradition of inclusive, participatory democracy. It offers the peasant communes broadly defined access to the democratic process, even as it places rather narrow limits to the possibility of diverging from the communal consensus. In sharp contrast to continental Europe, the social contract on which the welfare state was built is one between the individual and the state, at the expense of the intermediary institutions of civil society, such as the family, charities, foundations, or non-profit companies. The latter are associated not with pluralism and freedom, but with demeaning private charity, unequal patriarchal relations, and informal uses and abuses of power. In Sweden, the state is instead conceived as the liberator of the individual from such ties of dependency, an order of things I have termed statist individualism. In other words, freedom has in Scandinavia come to be extremely positive rather than negative, and it is hardly surprising that liberal critics have been able to argue convincingly that Sweden is dramatically lacking in the area of civil and individual rights. The state-individual alliance has allowed for relatively equal positive freedoms, social rights, at the expense of individual liberty and free choice. Indeed, if we want to define Scandinavian political culture in terms of broader intellectual currents, it is Rousseau and the notion of general will, rather than Montesquieu's notion of separate powers or Locke's liberal suspicion of excessive state power, that proves enlightening. Turning to Rousseau's social contract, one finds a passage that in many ways could serve as the motto for, at the very least, the Swedish welfare state. The second relation is that of the members of the body politic among themselves, or of each with the entire body. Their relations among themselves should be as limited and relations with the entire body as extensive as possible, in order that each citizen shall be at the same time perfectly independent of all his fellow citizens and excessively dependent on the Republic. This result is always achieved by the same means, since it is the power of the state alone which makes the freedom of its members. While this position is one that tends to alarm readers of a more liberal bent, and partly for good reason, it is for many Swedes, as indeed it was for Rousseau, part and parcel of an outlook that holds that the informal and unchecked power of families, churches and charities is a much greater evil than the formal, distant and politically controllable power of the state. As one defender of the Swedish welfare state, the social commentator Peter Antman has noted, few welfare states are as consistently based on the idea of individual autonomy as is the Swedish. Virtually all of our welfare programs are tied to the individual person, not to the family or to the job, as is the norm in other Western countries. The struggle for full employment follows the principle that each person should have power over his or her own life. The delivery of welfare services through the public sector, rather than within the family, has constituted a process of emancipation. The pressure on the family has decreased. The dependency on other family members has diminished, as the performance of many, often instrumental, tasks have been placed outside the family domain. This perspective has informed social democratic policy in Sweden, not least in the area of gender, where the autonomy of women in relationship to men has been gained largely through the provision of daycare, on the one hand, and the encouragement of female participation in the labour market, on the other. Thus, insofar as Swedish national identity is tightly linked to the welfare state, the emphasis should be equally on welfare and the state. A decoupling of nation and state would appear to be wholly foreign to the Swedish political tradition. Indeed, it would be hard to even formulate in intelligible terms. As critics of Swedish statism like to point out, the terms nation, state, and society are in Swedish virtually synonymous. This must be understood in the context of concepts like subsidiarity and federalism, so central to the Christian democratic model for the EU, a model based fundamentally on the separation of the cultural nation, the civil society, and the political-economic state. Missing in Sweden is the kind of critique of the state that has become common among leading leftist thinkers on the continent and in Great Britain, who are not only suspicious of any talk of healthy nationalism, but who also tend to view statism, in Habermasian terms, as the colonization of civil society by the state. Not so in Sweden, where it has been the bourgeois parties on the right and the conservative libertarian think tank Timbro that in the 1990s tried to mobilize the rhetoric of civil society in an attempt to associate the Swedish welfare state with the totalitarian regimes to the east and the dangers of excessive state power and big government. Conversely, left-wing opposition to Europe, a salient feature during the same period, was rooted both in worries about the lack of an egalitarian democratic tradition in Europe south of Denmark, and in concern that harmonization of social policies would spell the end of Swedish-style statist individualism in favor of the dreaded Christian democratic alternative, returning the individual to the care and capriciousness of the traditional family and the charitable organization in civil society. Today, this legacy of democratic left-wing nationalism is challenged from two directions. On the one hand, there is the neoliberal right that is primarily critical of the state and of a politics that favors high taxes and tight regulations of global market actors. On the other hand, there is the human rights defending left that attacks the nation-state as xenophobic and nationalist. These two strands of globalism constitute a perfect storm. In the eye of this storm, and in the balance, lies the future of democracy, not to mention any meaningful politics of solidarity.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Bokförlaget Stolpe. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.